Hello everyone, and welcome to another exciting installment of 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm Andrew, and as per usual, I'm joined by my co-host Rob.
Hello!
But not as per usual, we're not joined by Mick.
No.
Oh, that was some double negative dancing about that I didn't like too much.
Yeah. I'm not going to go down the sinister route that we did last time.
Yeah, I feel like last time we maybe took the joke a bit too far, so I'm just going to flat out say that Mick is studying for exams. He'll be back kind of early September.
Yes. sorry. Whenever I've listened to the beginning of that episode, I'm always like, that is really disturbing.
It is. We went too dark, Rob. We went darker than we should have.
Do you know what else went darker than it should have?
Thor 2, The Dark World.
You've read my mind. Yes.
Boom. Back to old synergistic 4Panel. Bouncing ideas off walls. Yelling things. Mostly yelling things about Thor. Because, yeah, if you hearken back to our SDCC episode, but one of the big announcements was that Taika Waititi will be directing Thor 4, Love and Thunder.
Disney, seriously, okay. James Gunn, he's a bit of a kook, yeah? Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, two fantastically fun films. And then Taika Waititi comes along, Thor Ragnarok, an amazingly fun film. And three of the best Marvel films out of the MCU, I would say. Or three of the most enjoyable Marvel films out of the entire MCU. Not including Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp. So,
yep.
Disney, seriously, keep the nut jobs in the director's chair, right? They know what they're doing.
Yeah. Although I am quite annoyed that they went and announced it.
Yes.
Because I did have a whole episode planned about what the fourth Thor film could be, and it's going to be about all alternate versions of Thor. That was going to include the excellent joke that it should be called Thor 4, Thor and the Thor Corps.
And it has spawned a lot of Jane Foster memes.
Yep, because that was the big announcement that Jane Foster is going to be Thor in that film. So I figured we could maybe talk about what that's been like in the comics and some other things that could be incorporated into the next Thor film.
Yes, I am going to bring this up, and I know you don't want me to, but I'm going to have to start with it, okay? Because it is a big part of the actual Thor comics, and that is Nick Fury. You know where I'm going with this. There's been two versions of Nick Fury. One of them is Samuel L. Jackson, but the one who caused Thor to become unworthy in the first place, which led to the whole Jane Foster story arc, was the original Nick Fury, who is now, for some reason, imprisoned on the moon.
Yeah, he did a bad crime and had to go to moon prison.
Yeah, and the only person who's played that version of Nick Fury is David Hasselhoff.
I mean, you didn't have to mention the Hoff, Rob.
I feel like I did. I feel like it was a duty to all comic book fandom who have conveniently forgotten that the Hoff once played Nick Fury.
Well, actually, I did read something interesting today while I was kind of trolling about the internets.
Oh?
So apparently way back, like, when they were going to do Iron Man.
Yeah.
Marvel did actually want to do White Nick Fury.
Really?
And yeah, and apparently the person they wanted to cast was George Clooney.
Ooh, that's an interesting choice. See, I don't know. I don't know if George Clooney would be my first choice to play Nick Fury.
Yeah, I feel like he's a bit too kind of suave and smooth for Nick Fury, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a bit too Pierce Brosnan.
But then again, don't know if you've seen Catch 22 that they did recently on Channel 4.
I haven't, no.
Yeah, because he plays the drill sergeant in that, and he's really good. So I could see it.
Okay, I'll have to watch that because I haven't seen that yet.
Everyone should watch that anyway, because it was a really good adaptation.
Okay, I think I'll watch that.
Bringing our chariot pulled by two goats back on track. So this is how the Jane Foster Thor story started. Is that, you know, original recipe Thor, he was basically told by Nick Fury
Sorry.
Yeah. That's how we're distinguishing.
Again, so if we're distinguishing original thaw as original recipe thaw, and we're going, I'm going to run with the KFC thing, you know this. Does that mean Eric Masterson was the extra crispy version?
God, maybe. Anyway, so yeah, Nick Fury, he basically told Thor a thing. I feel like we're just going to gloss over what the thing is, because that's just going to be a whole massive diversion again.
Yeah.
But basically it made Thor realize that, you know, kind of he is inherently unworthy, as all gods are really unworthy, because they put themselves above mortals.
Yeah.
And so he just could not lift Mjolnir anymore. And that led to a whole new story where initially a mysterious unknown figure, you know, went and picked up Mjolnir, and she became the new Thor. And eventually that was revealed to be Jane Foster.
Yeah. Jane Foster,
before we get to all of it, this is kind of the Jason Aaron Thor.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's a Thor comic written within the past, like, 6 years. So, of course, it's Jason Aaron.
Yeah.
Because, goddamn, he has been the Thor writer for a long time. And, like, as much as I've loved his run, that, for me, was kind of a bit of a mistake, making the new Thor a mystery for as long as they did.
See, I kind of liked the fact that they were playing around with it, but they also telegraphed it in a big way. I mean, when they eventually did the big reveal of who Thor actually, or the female Thor was, I found it quite underwhelming, because I kind of figured it out, like, several issues before.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, no, for a while it was kind of one of those points where it's definitely either Jane Foster or it's Thor's new girlfriend, Roz Solomon.
Yeah. But
it was kind of just waiting to see which one of those it was.
I figured out it was Jane Foster because there was something that was said. It was in one of the speech things. It was in one of the bits of dialogue. And it suddenly clicked and I went, oh, right, so she's Thor.
Yeah. But yeah, anyway, I feel like the thing with the mystery, though, was initially it was kind of hard to know, okay, why do I care about this new character who's Thor?
Yeah.
But then they revealed it was Jane Foster. And not only was it Jane Foster, it was Jane Foster who is suffering from a pretty aggressive form of cancer.
And is terminal.
And, well, no, it's not terminal.
No.
She was very specifically getting chemotherapy for it.
Yeah.
But when she transforms into Thor, it flushes all the toxins out of her system, therefore, like, undoing all her chemo every time she transforms.
Do you know what it was like?
Was it like if you could turn into an Asgardian god, but also it was killing you, and you've got to decide, you know, do I do it or do I leave it? What do I do? And is that a really compelling story beat? Because yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. And the reason why I know that is because they've done it before with Captain Marvel. Because Captain Marvel knew he had cancer long before the death of Captain Marvel. It was actually written in as part of the comics for a while beforehand, and he'd been getting treatment for cancer long before the death of Captain Marvel was made. Because the death of Captain Marvel didn't just suddenly appear out of nowhere. And so they have actually done the whole cancer storyline before. It's just, I'm not saying it wasn't as powerful as it was then, now, because it's still a powerful story. And yeah. I love the tagline.
Also, very important point.
Yeah.
Captain Marvel never had the tagline, the body is weak, but the thunder is strong.
Exactly. I was just about to mention the tagline as well.
Just such a good tagline.
It is so. And the thing is, I admit I was underwhelmed when they did the big reveal, but not underwhelmed in the way they did the big reveal. I was underwhelmed by the fact that it was Jane Foster, but only because I'd figured out it was Jane Foster. But the way they actually did it, the way it was drawn, the way it was written, I was actually really impressed by that. You know, when she transforms and you just see her in the hospital gown and saying, you know, I'm the mighty Thor and it's killing me.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that also kind of underlines the point that the story of Jane being Thor is far more interesting than, like, the mystery of who that Thor is.
Yes.
So they should have just gone with that from the start.
Yes.
Just like they should have revealed why Thor was unworthy from the start.
Yeah.
That was a mystery that went on for bloody yonks.
Far too long. Far too long.
Donkey's years. So yeah, I think the thing with Jane is I'm interested to see how much of that is going to carry over into the film.
I don't know. I mean, it's Taika Waititi directing, and we know he likes to have fun with his films.
Yeah. But I mean, his films have also, like, had a bit of kind of dark stuff in them as well.
Yeah. What We Do in the Shadows is incredibly dark at times.
Yeah. And so I feel like he would be a good fit for it, because he is good at taking something that's actually super dark, but still making, like, an approachable film.
Oh, Hunt for the Wilder People is incredibly dark at times as well.
Yeah.
It's hilarious, but still incredibly dark. I think if anyone was going to handle the cancer-ridden Jane Foster becoming Thor storyline and actually make it a movie that you would enjoy watching, then I think Taika Waititi's right up there amongst the first choices.
Yeah. To be fair, I think it's not even about being enjoyable, because I'm sure it is a compelling story and you could easily make a very good film of it.
Yeah.
It's just doing that, but also kind of fitting with the general tone of the MCU.
Yeah. It's such a big part of the Jane Foster story arc. I think that they probably will include it.
I hope so, because for me, that is what makes that character such a good character.
Yeah, because you have that balance between weakness and strength, toughness and fragility, well, life and death.
Yeah.
And
plus, and I think it's an interesting contrast, because you've got Thor, who's always seen his powers as like this great gift.
Hmm.
And then you've got Jane, who's also got that, but then they've also this massive burden.
One of the things I loved about Jane Foster being Thor, one of the things I thought was so well done during that run. Number one, you found out more about Mjolnir, what was inside Mjolnir. Because it wasn't just that Thor had the power of lightning, whatever, thunder, whatever it was. Yeah? He's the god of thunder. But it's as though he wasn't born with that. He kind of inherited it from the hammer. But the hammer contains, well, the comics have been out for a while, so is this a spoiler?
No, I think it's probably not a spoiler.
Okay. The hammer contains the mother of storms. And Jane...
This is a good point, because I guess they're going to have to find a way to bring Mjolnir back in the films.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the one in Endgame is from the past.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll sort that out.
Yeah, they probably will. Well, since the hammer contains the Mother of Storms, or in the comics it does anyway, because Jane had a connection with Mjolnir in the comics that Thor never had. It's like Mjolnir was Jane's friend, confidant, that sort of thing.
Is it a gal pal?
Yeah, gal pal, basically. I remember that scene after she's beat the crap out of some bad guy. She kisses the hammer and sends it to the moon.
Yep.
That's something that Thor would never do. Thor would never address Mjolnir as an actual being.
In his defense, I suppose he didn't, like, know it was sentient.
Yeah, he didn't, but... Sorry, I'm just remembering the scene in Thor Ragnarok. It's like, oh my god, the hammer pulled you off.
Oh god. Cog's definitely going to be back as well, isn't
he? Yes.
That's if he can stop playing Fortnite for the duration of a film.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. But Jane Foster, Thor, was kind of the prelude. Is it prelude? Prelude? However you pronounce that word, I can never remember. But it was kind of the precursor to, or the prequel to, The War of the Realms.
Yeah, that's kind of the big through story of Jason Aaron's Thor.
Yeah.
Which I feel like probably isn't going to be the subject of the film.
Yeah, I think the subject of the film, I don't think they're going to do the whole female Thor versus Odin bit, because Odin's dead in the MCU.
Yep.
But they could do a kind of War of the Realms thing-ish. Maybe they'll have Jane fighting the Shi'ar gods again. I don't know.
Yeah, see, I doubt it's going to be pulled directly from Aaron's run, just because with the title of it, it's probably more like a fun, rompy adventure.
Or since Thor now knows that there are other people who are worthy of wielding Mjolnir, and since he's restarted that forge as well, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Because the titles...
It's supposed to be a one-time deal or not, but yeah, they could always just have it back up and running in the film.
Yeah, see, we know the metal that Mjolnir's made of. There is a surviving dwarf, pretty big for a dwarf, but he's surviving, and he could forge another Mjolnir, couldn't he? Thor has the power to imbue Mjolnir with the power of thunder. So, what if... This is a wild idea. This is just me speculating completely here. But what if Love and Thunder, I'm going literally, quite literally with the title, what if that is basically, because Thor is pretty hung up on the fact that he and Jane were an item. So what if that's basically him trying to win her back in some kind of 80s rom-com movie type thing? You know, standing outside her window, you know, instead of the boombox, he's got a Mjolnir for her?
I don't know.
I know it's a stretch. It's complete
stretch.
It's
more likely that maybe, like, Thor gets a new Mjolnir, but then Jane picks it up and she becomes Thor, and it's maybe probably about, like, kind of looking at what makes different people worthy or something.
Possibly, yeah. Possibly.
See, I thought it might be interesting if they maybe go with an idea from the comics. It's not really, like, an official team, but it's, like, it's a group that's loosely referred to as the Thor Corps. Where Thor ends up teaming with kind of a bunch of other people with the powers of Thor. Maybe sometimes even like alternate universe versions of himself.
Like Throg.
Like Throg. With a man named Simon Walters. Simon Walterson, which is of course a reference to Walt Simonson, one of like the definitive Thor writers. Who was an ordinary man, got turned into a frog, helped out Thor when he was also turned into a frog, got a tiny sliver of Mjolnir, turned into a tiny hammer. And now he's just a frog with the power of Thor.
Yeah, he's the Frog of Thunder.
But yeah, I mean, basically this, what I want is just Marvel give me a Thor movie with all the other cool Thor characters. You've got like Throg and also Beta Ray Bill.
Yes, I was avoiding mentioning Beta Ray Bill because he's the horse in the room. I don't want to say elephant because he's more equine than that, isn't he?
He is indeed. Because I love the idea of Beta Ray Bill, which... And again, he is a character made by Walter Simonson.
Yep.
And just the idea of, like, Thor comes across this spaceship, and inside he finds, like, this really horrific-looking alien monster. Like, he's big, he's bulking, he's got a face like a horse's skull. And, you know, Walter Simonson, even to the... He said, I made a guy who looked like as much like just an awful monster as I could. And then he picks up Mjolnir. Because he's, like, actually this good and noble and pure spirit.
Yep. One of the things I love about Beta Ray Bill, and this was in the Unworthy Thor miniseries, was when he finds out that Thor has lost his hammer, he immediately says, take mine.
Yeah, because he's just the best bro.
Yeah, he is. Beta Ray Bill is basically, what's that character? Solas from Mass Effect? Can't remember his first name. You know the one who everyone, who was like the best bro to every player of Mass Effect?
Do you mean Rex?
Was it Rex?
Your big dinosaur friend.
The one who like always had your back and everything?
I mean, by the nature of the game, I think that's all of them, Rob.
You know what I mean.
But I assume you either mean Rex or Garrus.
Garrus, that's it. Garrus, not Solas. Garrus.
Yeah, Solas is more than Solas, the weird scientist dude.
Yeah, Garrus was the one that everyone... really,
I mean, who is also a good friend.
Yeah. But Garrus was the one who everyone adored.
Yep. It's either your bestest bro or your one true love.
And that is Beta Ray Bill to a lot of comic book fans, a lot of Thor fans as well. In fact, all Thor fans. I don't know of a single Thor fan that I've met in my entire life who does not think Beta Ray Bill is better than Thor.
You know, I guess he's also like Garrus. In that they are both horrifying alien creatures who can absolutely get it.
This is true.
Anyway, it's time, Rob.
What?
The hour of reckoning is upon us.
Okay.
Because when there is talk of alternate Thors...
Yes.
There must be talk of Thunderstrike.
See, I didn't bring it up. I want that on the record. I did not bring up Thunderstrike. I avoided speaking about Eric Masterson. I avoided speaking about giant shoulder pads with lightning bolts on them or Mohawks with lightning bolts on them.
Yeah. At least that one I feel like was just like a bit of a joke costume.
The thing that bugs me a little bit about Thunderstrike is that he was and wasn't part of the Thor Corps.
It was because, I mean, for a little while, he was Thor.
Yeah, it was Eric Masterson.
It's like, first of all, he was... So Eric Masterson was a guy who was an architect. Then he got badly injured fighting a Thor villain. Which, to make this character even worse, I found out the Thor villain who fatally wounded Eric Masterson was the Mongoose.
Yep.
So yeah, he was dying. So Odin said, okay, Thor, you merged with him now. So it was kind of like the Donald Blake thing, only where they're two separate people.
Yeah.
And then they got unseparated, but then Eric was just Thor for a bit. But then I think he like got tricked into attacking Sif or something. And so Odin just said, nah, mate, give me that hammer. Here's a mace, which is like Mjolnir, but a bit worse. And then he died.
Yeah, well, I mean, the way he died was, well, it was interesting, I suppose you'd say, but it was very 90s.
Yeah, he died using a weapon called the Blood Axe.
Yeah, we'll get into Blood Axe in a second, okay? I just want to leave Blood Axe just on the shelf there. We'll take him down in a second, don't worry. Because Blood Axe is so 90s, it hurts.
I mean, you shouldn't, Rob, because then you'll be cursed with insatiable bloodlust.
Here's the thing about Thunderstrike, right? Or about Eric Masterson as Thor. Eric Masterson was the Thor during the Infinity Gauntlet.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I just want to make that clear. Eric Masterson, not Thor, was the one who fought Thanos.
I think that explains a lot about how that story went, doesn't it?
Yes. See, it pointed out certain issues or certain flaws in Doctor Strange's magic because there was a time limit on Eric Masterson's transformation. He could only stay as Thor as long as he was holding Mjolnir. If he let go of Mjolnir for any reason for like an hour, then time would be up and he would transform back into Eric Masterson.
I don't know, was it an hour? Because I think it was a reference to the bit of the Donald Blake stuff, and that was if he lost all of Mjolnir for like 60 seconds, he would turn back to Donald Blake.
As soon as Mjolnir is sent through a wormhole by Thanos, he knows he's basically got to take the fight to Thanos, so he starts beating the crap out of him. Actually, it might have been 60 seconds, you never know, because then he turns to glass and he smashes him. Yeah, probably 60 seconds, maybe an hour was me overestimating it.
I mean, that's time for like a delicious slice of pizza.
Yeah, but the whole thing with him is when he reverts back into Eric Masterson in space, because Doctor Strange has cast a spell on everybody so they can breathe in space, they can breathe in vacuum. But that spell only works for Thor. It doesn't work for Eric Masterson. And I'm like, hang on, Doctor Strange is the master of mystic arts. Surely he already knows Eric Masterson is Thor. He's got the all-seeing
eye. Not necessarily. I mean, the whole point is that as Thor is like, indistinguishable from regular Thor.
That's why I said Thunderstrike was extra crispy. Because Eric Masterson Thor was basically if they changed the recipe, you know, like Coca-Cola did. But then everyone complained, so they had to go back to original recipe Thor. But then they introduced new extra crispy Thor.
Exactly. But yeah, he's just worse Thor.
He is. Because all of the stuff that came out of Thor's mouth, when he'd say verily and stuff like that, you kind of expected it because he's an Asgardian. But when it came out of Eric Masterson's mouth, you're like, yeah, no, it just don't work.
That being said, I would love Taika Waititi to do something with it.
Yes.
Like, just, it's the final battle, and some other dude rocks up with a hammer and goes, how are you doing? My name's Eric. Ideally, in this version, he's also from New Zealand.
Yeah.
Make it deliberately just... He's just some guy who found a hammer.
Wasn't there a Thor like that? One of the different versions of Thor was basically...
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure in one of, like, the... might have been the Marvel Noir universe, where it's like, no one has superpowers except for Spider-Man for some reason.
Yes.
And Thor's just some guy who's got, like, a hammer.
Yes.
And likes to hit people with it.
Thor, Love and Thunder. Let's get back to Thor, Love and Thunder, because I think we've talked enough about Thunderstrike. As I promised, taking Blood Axe down off the shelf. Blood Axe was an axe that was cursed and it would give the wielder immense power, and it gave the wielder immense power, and he thought he was going to be a hero, but the urge to kill, which was part of the axe's curse, became too strong, and he basically transformed him into a character who had a red skull.
And a big red chain.
A red skull, a big red chain.
And a black leather jacket.
And a black leather jacket and a giant axe. Now, this is Marvel we're talking about. Marvel's history with characters that have red skulls is not very good.
I mean, I like that he's basically someone who looked at Ghost Rider. What if... No, this Ghost Rider guy, he's not metal enough. What if we give him a big axe?
Yeah.
And also his skull covered in blood.
Thunderstrike versus Blood Axe was hilarious because you had the Avengers involved. And Thunderstrike versus Blood Axe was basically, look, I have leather pants with leather knee protectors, and I have a ripped denim jacket with no sleeves. Look at it. It's got no sleeves. And I have this body protector underneath, and I have a mace, and I have a ponytail and a beard, and my name is Thunderstrike, versus biker leathers, chain, red skull, Blood Axe. You see what I mean about Saw 90s? It hurts.
It is. That is comics with an X.
So, yeah. The whole ending of Thunderstrike was he didn't have enough power because apparently Thunderstrike didn't give him enough power to get rid of the Blood Axe, so he had to turn both his weapons against each other, which killed him.
He's just not very good.
He isn't. He's not very good at all. And there was the overly schmaltzy ending to that as well, where Thor appears at Eric Masterson's grave and carves on it in lightning, "The world still needs heroes."
I think what was going to happen was he was typing and he ran out of space, and it was going to be, "The world still needs heroes. Luckily, we've still got a bunch rather than this nerd."
But anyway, Love and Thunder. Love the lettering for Love and Thunder. It's so 80s metal, isn't it?
It is, and very, like, classic fantasy.
Yes.
Hunky, rippling men, scantily clad maidens type fantasy stuff.
Yes, which is basically what Thor is.
It is. It's that but superheroes, which is fun.
Yep. I honestly cannot predict where Taika Waititi is going to take the Thor franchise next. All I know is that if it's up to the same standards of his previous works, then it's going to be a hell of a lot of fun, regardless of what story he chooses to follow.
Yeah, that seems about right to me.
He's one of the few directors that I have complete faith in at the moment.
Yeah, I've yet to see anything by him that's disappointed me.
I've seen all but one of his films, and every single one of his films that I've seen, including Boy, is hilarious.
I cannot wait for Jojo Rabbit.
Oh.
Just the bit in the trailer where, like, the kids sing on the bench and then he, as imaginary Hitler, just pops up like, yeah, people used to hate me too.
No.
Said so many mean things about me.
How do you get away with that? That's
You beat Taika Waititi. Like, I don't think there's anyone else who could get away with, like, whimsical comedy Hitler in this day and age.
Exactly.
Maybe that's going to be the villain in Love and Thunder.
Whimsical comedy Hitler?
Yes.
Oh.
Oh, my God, Taika Waititi, but he's, like, in charge of Hydra.
Oh, God. Can you imagine if Taika Waititi decided to remake The Great Dictator?
I could see it.
With him as the lead role, because he is very Chaplin-esque, isn't he?
Or just do, like, a full version of Springtime for Hitler.
Oh, the directors by Taika Waititi.
You mean the producers,
right? Oh, sorry, the producers, yeah, sorry. The producers by Taika Waititi. There's so many films that I'd like to be remade by Taika Waititi. Do you know that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I want every, like, overly serious action film to be remade by Taika Waititi.
Do you know what I would put top of the list, though, of films to be remade by Taika Waititi? Because I think he'd do an amazing job with it. The Last Action Hero.
Yeah, I think that works very well with his sensibilities.
Yeah. Because it's already halfway there, isn't it?
Yeah. But yeah, basically, Love and Thunder, I'm excited.
Yes.
And I think, is this where we should take a break?
Yeah.
Well, I may be hungry, but there's always time for the Geek Show.
Hello, do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week and do it reasonably well.
And welcome back. Now we're going to be talking about what we've been reading. So, Rob, do you want to kick things off?
Yes, I've been reading Dead Man Logan. Because no longer is he just Logan, no longer is he Old Man Logan, he is now Dead Man Logan. Now, I thought, when I looked at this, because the cover is very kind of black and brown and blood, with a Wolverine who's old and grizzled and missing an eye, has an eye, gone blind, and he's all tattered, and there's blood everywhere, and yada, yada, yada. And I thought, Dead Man Logan, is he a zombie Logan? Is this some weird Marvel zombie thing that I didn't know about? But no, it's apparently the writing is on the wall. Old Man Logan is dying, which is kind of what happens in life anyway, because he's not immortal. But anyway, apparently his healing factor...
I mean, you could have fooled me.
Yeah, his healing
factor... The way this is dragged out.
Oh, God, yeah, I know. His healing factor is no longer working, and so he is dying, and apparently he'll be dead in 12 months, if not sooner, because he keeps abusing himself. And so this is Logan's last adventure, or Old Man Logan's last adventure, in the present time, which is his past. And it starts off with the, you know, with... Glob and Forge and a few other X-Men finding Logan and a headless green body. And the headless green body is the body of Maestro, and Logan's cut off his head. Because Logan is out on a mission now because he knows that he doesn't have long left. He gets that confirmed when he wakes up in the mansion. He's only got 12 months left to live. And so he is going to spend his time doing what he does best. And what he does best is tracking people, which is pointed out in this series. It's one of the better bits of this particular mini-series. It's pointed out that when he says, I'm good at finding people, it makes him sound like a creepy stalker. More than one person comments on that, and then when he meets himself at the end, and he says it, he's like, yeah, you're right, it does make me sound like a creepy stalker. But in the run-up to that, you have this entire story arc that involves Miss Sinister, a bunch of bad guys, Neo Hydra, Red Skull's daughter Sin, who's dating Crossbones in Neo Hydra, and Mysterio, who, if everybody remembers, they probably don't, but if everyone does remember, is the reason why Old Man Logan is Old Man Logan in the first place, because Mysterio can basically trick Old Man Logan to kill all of the X-Men.
Yeah, also, Neo Hydra, that's on the nose, isn't it?
Yes, I know. Mysterio, at this point, though, has no intention of fooling anybody into killing anything, because Mysterio has basically hidden himself away in a mental institute and wants to be left alone in his own little kingdom. Which, I thought, well, okay, he's not hurting anybody. He's basically locked himself away. He doesn't want to keep getting beaten up by Spider-Man or X-Men or Daredevils or anybody else. He just wants to be left alone. So leave him alone.
Like how increasingly on this podcast we've just come to the realisation that Mysterio is a bit of a dork.
Yeah, he is.
I don't like that about him.
Yeah. I mean, he's living in this world of illusions that he's created for himself, and so... But Miss Sinister pulls him back into the world of the bad guys, and he really doesn't want to be there because he realises that he's expendable to Sin and Hydra and Miss Sinister and everybody else. He realises that straight away. But Logan is on the warpath because Logan wants to make sure that Mysterio never ever tricks the current Wolverine into killing the X-Men. So Logan is
no,
out.
Rob, this is Wolverine. Warpath is a different X-Men.
Sorry, Warpath. A Wolverine, sorry. Wants to make sure that Wolverine will never kill the begin with W, and it's so confusing because there's so many X-Men.
Yeah, no, I was joking because you said he's on a warpath.
Oh, well, sorry.
It was a fun bit.
I thought I'd called him Warpath. Yep, you got me. Damn it. Anyway, breaking my floor. I had floor there. It's not often I get floor. So anyway, Logan is basically hunting Mysterio to basically get rid of Mysterio so that he never tricks Wolverine into killing the X-Men. And so they're in Times Square and Logan starts attacking the Avengers, who he thinks are the Sinister Six, yada, yada, yada. And that's one of the bad parts about this, because Logan being Logan, he's been through this before. You'd think that he wouldn't automatically dive straight in and start attacking the Sinister Six. He would first go, I've been through this before. Should I, you know, and they're telling me, please don't make me do this. They're saying, please stop, Logan. They're calling me by my name. Shouldn't that be a tell that maybe I'm attacking the wrong people? Maybe I'm under the influence of another illusion?
Oh, okay, so it's Mysterio making them look like the Sinister Six.
Yes.
It's not Logan going, that man's dressed like the American flag. I bet he's Dr. Octopus.
Yes. So anyway, Mysterio's realised that he's expendable to all of the people who are trying to get him to work for them and get rid of all of the Avengers and the X-Men and everything like that, using the power of Logan. And so he goes to the only person who can help him, the only person he feels comfortable and will be willing to listen and is able to help him. He goes to Hawkeye.
Which one?
Clint Barton Hawkeye.
I mean, you've made a choice, Logan.
And he could have gone to Spider-Man. He could have gone to the Avengers. He could have gone to anybody else. He went to Clint Barton.
Do you know, the Avengers are probably a bit miffed from that one time he went, that guy's some kind of Iron Man. I bet he's Kraven the Hunter.
This has a lot of punching, a lot of shooting, a lot of killing people, and also a weird, bizarre scene involving Captain America and Old Man Logan. No, it's not that sort of bizarre scene, you filthy, filthy people. But it does have one rather interesting and rather touching bit at the end. And that's when Wolverine goes to meet Mariko Yoshida, who now is living a new life away from the Hand, is it? Who resurrected her? I keep getting confused.
I heard she was dead.
Yeah, the Hand resurrected her in order to try and take over the Yoshida Corporation.
Huh.
Yeah, so she's alive again. And she doesn't want to be around Wolverine, but he basically shows her a picture of a young girl who, in 50 years' time, becomes his wife in his reality, in his timeline, but who also, the trouble that he always invites, ends up killing her. And so he wants her to have a good life. He's saved up a bunch of money, and he asks Mariko to make sure that she stays away from super types, from that sort of life. She doesn't get involved with them, which I thought was a rather touching scene. And then you have Wolverine meeting Wolverine, and then it ends in a fight, and he goes back to the future, because the future. So Deadman Logan, better than I thought it was going to be. It had some interesting bits, but still not great. Still not great.
I still think my main problem is, like, because we had all the palaver with, like, young Logan coming back to life, which went on for, God, I think like 2 years by the time I actually came back.
Well, this collects Deadman Logan numbers 1 to 6. And this is written by Ed Brisson, with art by Mike Anderson, colours by Nolan Woodward, letters by VC's Corey Petty, and cover by Declan Shalvey. So we'll see if there's more issues. I'm expecting there to be another 6 issues that finish the story off now that he's in the future again.
Yeah, there's another 6 issues until they reveal, surprise, he's actually still alive, man, Logan. And then maybe, like, after 20 issues of that, he'll be, okay, for realsies, though, this time he's dead.
Yeah. I wouldn't say I was a big fan of Old Man Logan in general. Dead Man Logan, like I said, it was better than I thought it was going to be, and that's me not being a fan of Old Man Logan, because I think a lot of it is just not very good. But this was better than I thought it was going to be. But still, it's not that great. There are better Wolverine story arcs that you could read that would satisfy that Wolverine itch that you have. And if you've got a Wolverine itch, maybe see a doctor.
Disgusting. Anyway, while we're here being disappointed by X-Men,
yep,
I've been reading Uncanny X-Men, Wolverine and Cyclops, which is the first volume of the run by Matthew Rosenberg, Salvador LaRocca, who did the writing and the art respectively, colours by Rochelle Rosenberg, and letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. So this is the first six issues of the most recent X-Men run before the Jonathan Hickman stuff, which I think I mentioned last time is amazing. You should all be reading it. Get on that. And the idea behind this one is this is the series that was running kind of concurrently with Age of X-Men. So that's the series in which a bunch of the X-Men got swallowed up into this parallel universe. But meanwhile, back in the normal universe, Cyclops is back alive, only to find that the rest of the X-Men is seemingly dead, and he's now got to contend with a world where basically the X-Men's worst fears have come to light. Like, with there being barely any mutants left, the US government's finally just gone, screw it, let's just kill them all. And so, with extinction looking kind of imminent, Cyclops decides he's going to build a team of the last remaining X-Men and just basically, you know, cross off all the enemies on their bucket list before their inevitable deaths. And I think that was a really cool setup that this series just absolutely fails to follow up on, because it's... And again, this is coming from the perspective of having read the entire run. It was just all a bit of a mess, because I think it's very much Matthew Rosenberg basically being told, okay, you get to do an X-Men run before we just reboot everything, do what you want. Okay. And so there's just this real sense of he's trying to cram every single thing he's ever wanted to write into each issue. Because, let's just start with the team. Because the team's initially Cyclops and Wolverine. Then they recruit, Danny Moonstar, Karma, Magic, Wolfsbane, Havoc, and Multiple Man. That's a pretty big team, isn't it?
Yep.
And then they just go on to add, Chamber and Revanche and Hope Summers and Banshee. And that's and then Warlock and also Dark Beast. It's 14 characters.
That's far too many for a team.
Yeah, because I feel like outside of Cyclops, Wolverine, and Havoc, they barely get any character development. A lot of them. Especially Magic, which is weird because Matthew Rosenberg did New Mutants Dead Souls, where she was a main character. And this, she's mostly just kind of in the background. So yeah, there's that, and it's they're fighting new villains in every issue, and they're setting up all these things, the government hates us, and one issue is literally Magneto is cloned, Joseph, he's back, he's got a new Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, what are they doing, we've got to fight them, oh wait, no, now he's dead, look, it's revenge, she's going to join the X-Men now, and then not even really appear in the issues and maybe get five lines across the whole thing. It's really hectic. It's really crammed. And I think the worst part is it's also got a very dark tone. So lots of characters die, but it's always just someone a strong guy will be killed off.
Mm.
And then three panels later, they don't even mention it because they've moved on to the next beat. It's just, I don't think I've ever read a comic that's been this physically exhausting.
Wow.
By the end of every issue, I've got a bit of a headache. And this is the series before they even really introduce what the plot is, which they do in, the last three issues.
Question.
Is Salvador LaRocca's art horrible? Yes, it is. Thank you for asking, Rob.
Second question. Why does this exist?
Like I said, Matthew Rosenberg being told, you've got carte blanche. You know when there's an all-you-can-eat buffet?
Yeah.
And everything's really good. So you shovel it all onto your plate, and then you look down and you realise you've got way too much than you can comfortably eat. And also it's all turned into like just this one big kind of slurry.
See, I go
the series is kind of that.
I go with the other end of the spectrum. I distrust any all-you-can-eat buffet because I'm just worried that someone spat on the food at some point.
Thank you for that.
Sorry. Because this does sound like the kind of comic where the writer's going, nah, I'm just going to do whatever I want. I spit on all my readers.
I don't know. It's not that contemptuous. So it's kind of sad because Matthew Rosenberg is clearly a guy who loves the X-Men. He's had eyes bigger than his belly.
Okay. So,
and also, I think I'm being harder on it in retrospect, knowing that a lot of the plot points that get set up just get resolved very hastily.
Okay.
So yeah. Read House of X and Powers of 10 instead. They're very good.
Powers of 10?
Powers of 10.
Is it not Powers of X? It's Powers of 10?
Yeah, no, it's specifically Powers of 10. Because it's about different timelines increasing by a factor of 10.
Okay. I thought it was just Powers of X, because you did say it was Powers of X before.
No, I didn't, Rob, because I never make mistakes.
But we released it's that episode.
Powers of 10, House of X.
We released that episode already.
No, it's you, listeners. You're wrong.
Speaking of something that's
this
wrong.
This is maybe why no one listens to us, Rob. Because we make bad mistakes and they yell at the listeners for it.
Yeah. Speaking of things that are wrong, West Coast Avengers, it's so wrong. So very, very wrong. None of you should read West Coast Avengers. You should just let me read it, and none of you should read it at all, because, I think that it's so wrong that you should not go anywhere near it, and it should be left alone for me to enjoy by myself.
I mean, good news, Rob. It was, and that's why it was cancelled.
Damn it. But it's so good.
Well, you shouldn't have bluffed away all the... This is entirely your fault, Rob.
But it's so good. This is Mockingbird all over again, isn't it?
It is. Although in retrospect, it was maybe a good thing that Mockingbird got cancelled because turns out Chelsea Kane is a bit of a yikes.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We won't go there. Anyway, West Coast Avengers. This is City of Evils. And this collects West Coast Avengers 2018 issues 5 to 10. And, well, where do I begin? This is written by Kelly Thompson with art by Daniel D. Nicuolo, Gang Hyuk Lim and Moy R, and colours by Triona Farrell and Gang Hyuk Lim. And it's got letters by VCs Joe Caramagna, and covers by Stefano Caselli and Nolan Woodward, Edward Petrovich and Gang Hyuk Lim. And I have to say, the covers are good. The story is, well... If you remember, in the first volume, we had Braddock, we had Kate Bishop being turned into a 50-foot bird, who also fired arrows, called Kate Bishop. She was a hawk.
Yeah, she was.
And this starts off, the first cover is basically, you've got Madam Mask on the cover, but then you've got all of the West Coast Avengers in dodgems with Gwenpool in the back wielding a sword. But yeah, this starts off with some of the... Because they're doing this reality TV thing, which basically Captain America isn't happy about because he's had a bad experience with reality TV, which I am now curious about and I want to know more about. When did Captain America be on reality TV? I want to know. So listeners, if you know when Captain America was on reality TV... Do let me know, because I am curious as to why he hates it so much and why he's berating Kate Bishop about it at the very beginning.
Look, sometimes you go on Love Island, you have a bad experience, you get mugged off, something about salts, I think. I don't know the kid lingo, I'm old now.
Is Captain America the guy on Love Island who gets friend-zoned by everybody?
Yeah, I feel like comics Captain America definitely is.
Yeah. Anyway, this starts off with the Avengers West Coast fighting a giant robot made out of vehicles on the highway that has been created because Gridlock wants to stop all commuting and has created this giant robot made out of different vehicles. And so it's up to everyone to stop gridlock. And they do stop gridlock. So America goes out on a date with Ramona. Is it Ramon? Ramona? You know, Fuse's sister?
I think it's Ramon. Ramon. Specifically.
Anyway, I love the introduction.
She's not Ramona.
Oh, God, yeah. Please don't.
It's like Beck is in the podcast with us.
Yeah, please don't do that again because it reminds me of Scott Pilgrim. I'm never going to. Anyway, I love the way that Avengers West Coast introduces the different characters because you have Gwendolyn Poole, a.k.a. Gwenpool, knows all the secrets of the Marvel Universe, unclear superpowers, very mysterious. You got Johnny Watts, a.k.a. Fuse, ability to mimic any surface he comes into contact with, very new to superheroing, very new to dating Kate Bishop. You got Quentin Quire, a.k.a. Kid Omega, Omega-level telepathy and telekinesis, equally full of power and arrogance. Clint Barton, a.k.a. Hawkeye, best archer in the world, well, one of two, co-leader, mentor, babysitter extraordinaire. Kate Bishop, also known as Hawkeye, a.k.a. leader of the all-new West Coast Avengers, also shoots arrows. And America Chavez, strength, flight, invulnerability, opens dimensional gateways, will punch you into the sun if you're naughty. And so you have these disparate people who are later joined when they basically are attacked in a theme park. In a deserted theme park, a very creepy deserted theme park that looks like something out of Scooby-Doo, they are divided, and divide and conquer is the rule of the day because they're up against a supervillain team led by Madame Mask that includes, oh, what's his name? You know, Son of Satan? What's Damien Hellstrom? What's his sister called?
Oh, Satana.
Yeah, Satana is part of this Sinister Five? Maybe six? Maybe more? We don't know. But Madame Mask, Satana, MODOK, what was it, Graviton, various other people like
that. The eel is there.
The eel is in there as well, yes, who I'd never heard of before, but now I know. But anyway, the team gets separated. Quentin Quire and Gwenpool, who are kind of in this on again, off again, gone again, Finnegan relationship, end up in the Tunnel of Love.
Yep.
America and Clint end up in the Hall of Mirrors, and they don't kind of get along. Fuse ends up with Kate and Ramon, his sister, and so they end up getting blown up. They end up in a very 1960s Batman scenario where they are basically hanging in cages over a pool of sharks.
It's so Batman.
It is so Batman. They eventually manage to get out of there with the help of Mick's favourite character in the whole world, Marvel Boy. And I kind of wish Mick had actually covered this because Marvel Boy makes an appearance and then your favourite character in the whole world also makes an appearance in this.
Does Mick have particularly strong opinions on Marvel Boy?
Yeah, I don't think he likes Marvel Boy. But anyway, Marvel Boy's in this and he's kind of become part of the West Coast Avengers by extension through this adventure. At the same time, Gwenpool adopts a baby landshark who she calls Jeff. More on the baby
landshark.
Yeah, more on the baby landshark later. This continues on to be a lot of fun, and even more fun when you get to Marvel Boy's crazy wall. You know, his wall of string where he's connecting everything and comes up with scrolls when it's actually vampires.
I hate that you've done this review, Rob.
Why?
Because that was kind of... I'd finally gotten over the fact that West Coast Avengers was cancelled and this is bringing it all back.
It's so good, isn't it?
This was such a good series.
This has some amazing bits. I'm Gwen going into battle singing Gwen and Jeff, Jeff and Gwen, saving the day as best they can. And you got Gwenpool launching herself forward with shiny katanas and the Landshark launching himself forward with his tongue hanging out as if he's some kind of dog.
I love Jeff.
Yeah. You got Quentin with a psychic shotgun, which I think is one of the coolest things I've seen any mutant or psychic come up with. A psychic shotgun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. That's how he uses his powers.
So Avengers West Coast or West Coast Avengers. Do you know, I'm kind of glad that they did stop it because it makes me treasure it a lot more, knowing that there's not going to be any more.
But you could have treasured more of it.
I could happily have treasured more of it. But given the fact that it's finished, I'm happy that I get to go back and read it when I'm feeling blue or down or anything like that, and just enjoy it for what it is. Just pure, unadulterated comic book joy. Read this along with stuff like Next Wave, The Paybacks, Mockingbird, stuff like
that. The Paybacks, that's... I was trying to think of what that was called the other day.
Yeah, read West Coast Avengers along with stuff like that, because it's so entertaining, it's so much fun. And if anyone's going to direct a West Coast Avengers movie, it has to be Taika Waititi.
Ooh, I'd watch that. I'd watch the bejesus out of that.
You'd be in the cinema like a year before and you wouldn't move until the movie came on.
I wouldn't. I would be a pyrrhic victory because my spine would have disintegrated by the time the movie actually comes out.
Yeah.
But it's the principle.
So, anyway, Andrew.
Yep.
Happy
back
time's
to
over.
Me to finish things off, I've been reading Magus of the Library by Mitsu Izumi, based on Kafka of the Wind by Sophie Schwimm, yeah, and translated by Hiroto Hamada.
Yeah.
So, this is a manga set in the fantasy village of Amun, where a young boy named Theo is kind of, he sort of lives in the slums of the village, and he is kind of the one sort of traditional, he looks like a kind of traditional fantasy elf, so you know, pale skin, blonde hair, pointy ears. But this is a sort of more Middle Eastern inspired fantasy series, and so he's kind of, he's treated as a bit of an outsider.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is maybe a little bit problematic, but not enough that I could really comment on it. But yeah, but the one thing Theo does love is books, which he, you know, occasionally tries to sneak into the local library to read. And he dreams of one day going to the city of Aftzark, which is where the kind of big... Basically, it's a stand-in for the Library of Alexandria.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a big central library, all the kind of collected knowledge of the world. He wants to go there and become a librarian, but if only he can escape the confines of his small village life. But one day his life changes around when a group of Kafners, who are the kind of sort of librarian nuns, they come to visit the village, and he ends up kind of striking up a sort of relationship with them. And it's just... So I like that it's a fantasy world that, like I said, kind of takes more inspiration from the Middle East than kind of traditional sort of Middle Ages, Tolkien-esque fantasy.
It's more Arabian Nights than anything else, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's very Arabian Nights. Down to, probably my favourite bit is for some of the scenes, they've got like really elaborate details kind of in the margins of the pages.
All right.
Which is an effective, like, in general, the art in this is really good. And I like that there's one of those things where occasionally I'll throw in things like sort of a discussion on old-fashioned methods of like restoring books. Like one of the characters, she kind of goes in on a sort of a big lecture about like the proper way to do it. And I like that she even then turns to the reader and says, "Did you get all that?" That's always, I like it when kind of things like that are sort of sprinkled through, just little educational tidbits.
Yeah.
But God, is this a slow book?
Yes. I'll admit, I like it, but only because I worked as a librarian for a time. And so, having been a librarian, an old school librarian before you had all these fancy schmancy computers and stuff like that.
Yeah, I feel like it's definitely kind of a bit of, you maybe need to have a bit of a special interest in these things to really enjoy it.
Yeah, I think
there's just lots of, Theo's just a very, very vanilla fantasy protagonist.
Yeah.
He's the nice guy, but no one likes him. And he's really passionate about insert theme of series here. And one day he wants to be a insert theme of series here.
Yeah.
And it's just literally, it starts off like that and doesn't change like the entirety of this volume.
See, that's it's one just, that's one of the biggest problems I had with the first volume, exactly that.
Yeah, like it just seems like the end of every chapter is Theo going, yeah, I really like books. Then next chapter, you know, I still really like books. Next chapter, gosh, aren't books great?
See, I would have loved it if at some point you just went, paper cut, God, I hate books.
Yeah, exactly. That would have been, God, that would have been something, wouldn't it? Some kind of just narrative thrust. Yeah, but it's annoying because, like, by the end of the book, it's about him, like, a few years later saying, okay, I'm going to, like, go to Aftzark and become a librarian. And it just makes this whole thing feel like, this is just the prologue, basically.
Yeah, and it's
like
far
you
too
could
long.
Have, you could have done this in a chapter, really.
Yep, you could have. After the first book, it picks up. The story does pick up. But he doesn't really stop being a vanilla character.
Yeah, exactly. There's just like no real character development. And I feel like it's probably one of my biggest turnoffs of fantasy. Is you get these protagonists who they're, you know, very morally upstanding and good and bright. And that's it. You know, they're gonna go off and fight the great evil. And then they do, and everything's all hunky-dory.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there's a place for characters like that. You know, there has to be.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not the problem that that kind of character exists. It's that so many protagonists are that.
Yeah. And the thing is, with this story, the thing that bugs me about it is that books are a thing, books are a medium where there is so much range and depth, and you find that especially in the library. Now, okay, this is kind of Arabian Nights territory, so maybe all the books are formalized and everything like that. Maybe they probably don't have the pulpy horror fiction of the Victorian period or anything like that. Yeah? But
yep.
That doesn't mean to say there aren't going to be any fictional stories, because you know yourself, having read this, there are fictional stories in this with characters who are far more multidimensional than the character of the Magus of the Library.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's not so much with the story, but like the pirate Captain Shagrazart.
Yeah.
Give me a manga about him. I want to read about cool pirates.
Yeah, exactly. And his name, Shagrazart, that's a name with a story, isn't it?
That is, that. Like, actually, I was going to check. Because it sounds like an already existing character, but I don't know if it is.
So Google it and find out.
Yeah, too much effort. Yeah, speaking of laziness, don't know if like, that's another thing with the story, is it's just, its message just seems to be kind of a very generic, books are good, libraries are important, which, you know, they are. But I feel like that's a thing that's kind of already a common knowledge. It doesn't feel like it's, you know, doesn't feel like I'm getting anything that I don't already know.
Yeah, I think.
Actually, you know, if anything, going back to the whole vanilla protagonist thing.
Yeah.
I think it's not even specifically that that's a problem. It's just this sense of, yeah, I've seen this before. I think that's what turns me off, especially fantasy, because it's a genre that heavily relies on certain very well-worn tropes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Magus of the Library, not for me, but I'm sure there's something there for other people. It was also my birthday, and I got a bunch of great comics.
Okay, what'd you get?
You know, just to bounce out the downer stuff, I got some good stuff. I got a late volume of Deadly Class and Wicked and the Divine. Got the first volume of Die, which is about a group of kids who like play a fancy role-playing game, but then get sucked into the world. It's like, do you remember the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon series?
Yes.
That, but super dark.
So it's basically that crossed with Jumanji.
Yeah, and written by Kieran Gillen and with art by Stephanie Hans. So it is beautiful. And and to bring us to the end of the episode and tie things up neatly, I got the first two volumes of Walter Simonson's Ragnarok.
Nice.
Yes, it's great. It's about like a world after the Twilight of the Gods, where Thor gets brought back as just like a hulking zombie.
Wow.
It's freaking rad.
Right, okay. So, yeah, that brings us full circle. We are at the end of the episode. But like the serpent biting its tail, we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, you can catch all of our previous episodes on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, along with a bunch of other stuff and all the other shows on our network, and also our Patreon and our shop. You can also find our episodes on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Acast, Spotify, Deezer, basically anywhere where you get your podcasts from. We're also available on YouTube as well, so check those out. Until next time, I've been Rob.
Which I guess means I've been Ross.
Yeah.
Because then we're our Rob and Ross. Our Rob or Ross.
Yeah, which means Mick is R.
Heck yeah, Red Dwarf reference.
See, I went with R instead of our. So yeah, until next time then, keep reading those comics and we'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.